Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. And as this year comes to a close, we are looking back on some of the stories that dominated the news in 2013. Today, we will focus on the rise and fall of the Tea Party in 2013 and begin with a broadcast of Background Briefing for May 16, 2013, when the Tea Party was claiming political victimhood. We analyze the real nature of the Tea Party movement with Chris Parker, the author of a new book, Change They Can't Believe In, The Tea Party and Reactionary Politics in America. We discuss his thoroughly researched study of the Tea Party that presents itself as a new revolutionary phenomenon when in fact it is the old reactionary right repackaged as a grassroots movement. With its funding from billionaires, it is much more the heir of the Know-Nothing Party, the Ku Klux Klan, and the John Birch Society than to those who inspired the American Revolution. Then from October the 2nd, 2013, we speak with two Washington insiders who wrote the New York Times bestseller, It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism. Norman Ornstein and Thomas Mann were among the first to expose the capture of the Republican Party by extremists, and we discuss the threat to the Constitution posed by the Tea Party radicals who want nothing short of an unconditional surrender by Barack Obama of his presidency. Then finally, from October the 8th, 2013, we look into arguments before the Supreme Court in McCutcheon versus the FEC that could strike down any remaining limits on spending on candidates and parties. Senator Bernie Sanders, who was in the Supreme Court and later spoke on the steps afterwards, joins us to discuss whether the court will further empower a few billionaires like those behind the Tea Party shutdown who are radically altering the American political landscape, moving the country further and further to the right. And joining us now is Chris Parker, a professor of social justice and political science at the University of Washington. He is the principal investigator of the Multi-State Survey on Race and Politics and the director of the Center for Survey Research at the University of Washington and the author of Fighting for Democracy, Black Veterans and the Struggle Against White Supremacy in the Postwar South. And his latest book just out is Change They Can't Believe In, The Tea Party and Reactionary Politics in America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Chris Parker.
Thank you, Ian. I'm honored to be here.
And clearly the IRS is on the defensive, and so is the White House, by the way, today in the press conference with the Turkish Prime Minister. The President once again went after the IRS and said how terrible it is, and we have to be completely nonpartisan at the IRS. And, of course, the acting head has been fired or is obviously stepped down under fire. It's a bit hard to understand why the President is being so defensive at this point when, in fact, he could turn the whole thing around by pointing out that the IRS, in fact, hasn't done its job. It wasn't that they were doing too much, they were doing too little. These 501c4s have opened the floodgates for anonymous billionaires to pour millions and billions into our elections. And the IRS, basically, 90% of the applications have come from right-wing groups. So, you know, obviously they should have gone after Karl Rove, but I don't see the problem. Do you?
No, well, there is a slight problem in that, yes. I mean, it should be, the IRS should be, you know, politics-free. However, and it's a big however, the IRS went after the NAACP in 2004 because Julian Bond, the chairman at the time, he's now chairman emeritus, you know, spoke out against Bush policies, the war, the economy, and, you know, so on and so forth, right? So, you know, most people get audited, you know, after the IRS receives their taxes, but they got audited in October, which is an odd time. So so there's one example. Let me just call forth a couple other figures I think the listeners may be interested in. The first of which is there are about 296 potential political cases the IRS ended up with. That is to say, cases from the far right. Do you know how many were denied? I'm just going to ask you just a guess. I'll give you one educated guess. How many were denied?
Probably two.
No. Zero.
There you go.
Zero.
Right.
Were denied, right? So there are 108 approved, 28 cases in which the application was withdrawn by the applicant, and there are 160 cases that are now pending. Now, I will hazard a guess that those will go through scot-free, given the current political climate.
And your book, Chris Parker, Change They Can't Believe In, the brand new book that's just out here with co-author Matt Barreto, I guess makes the case that the Tea Party is not a revolutionary party, as it's been largely portrayed as in a benign way by both the left and the right-wing press, I would argue, going back to the idea that their roots come out of the outrage over the bailout on Wall Street, which for reasons that still mystify me, the political left in this country did not seize upon. But that's another argument. But I'm saying that what I get out of your new book is that the Tea Party is not a revolutionary party. It's a reactionary party.
Yes, that is very much so the case. So first of all, you know, some people want to make this argument, and I run into them all the time. Oh, yeah, the Tea Party, you know, they hated Bush, too. It's like the Tea Party did not exist on Bush's watch, right? It did not exist at all. Okay, let me just give you a few facts and figures about Bush, right? When we start talking about the deficit, for example, it expanded more than any other time in history. Oh, and we just found out this morning that the deficit has decreased. So projected decrease by $200 billion, right? We found that out this morning, right? So let me throw that on the table. Moreover, the increase in discretionary spending increased by a total of 49% on Bush's watch. Even if you compare Bush to Clinton, right, and looking at the federal government, on Clinton's watch, the federal government increased by 11%. On Bush's watch, it increased by 104%. Bush entered office with a $700 billion surplus, thanks to Clinton. He departed with a $1.3 billion deficit, which constitutes a $2 billion swing. TARP was initiated on Bush's watch, $700 billion bailout to GM, AIG, and Citigroup. So if conservatives were so upset, and the Tea Party claimed that they're really all about fiscal matters and small government, I ask you, where were they on Bush's watch?
Well, that's the point, though, isn't it? That, again, the point that you make in your new book, Change They Can't Believe In, Christopher Parker, co-authored with Matt Barreto, is that the Tea Party is just a repackaging of the far right in this country. You go back to the Know-Nothings, the Ku Klux Klan of the 1920s, and, as you just mentioned, the John Birch Society. I think that's a part of the brilliance of the Kochs and others, is that they've managed to make this look like it is something new when it is, in fact, something old and perpetually noxious.
Yeah, this sort of reactionary conservatism has been around for a very long time, as you mentioned. We tie it to the Know-Nothing Party of the 1850s, to the Klan of the 1920s, to the John Birch Society, and obviously to the Tea Party now. And what they all have in common is their definition of what a quote-unquote real American is, generally white, male, middle class and wealthier, older, Protestant, heterosexual. This is who the and it's riven, the social science literature is riven with this description, right? Both empirically and sort of thematically, right? That is who the real American is. And every time there's a threat, a possible sustained threat to this, you get one of these far-right reactionary movements that comes around because it's a reaction to what they perceive as rapid social change and that their America is being stolen from them, pilfered from them.
Well, but it seems to me, and I think in many ways Ronald Reagan, you know, and he's the darling of every conservative in this country, he appealed to that atavistic Ozzie and Harriet, June Cleaver era of black and white television that was really unreal to begin with. The only reason that we had white America then living this perfect American dream was that blacks and Hispanics were invisible. They were there, but they weren't shown. And what's happened since is that the rest of America, the other real Americans, they've gradually stepped out of the shadows. And is that what they can't deal with?
Yeah, it's that, but it's what Obama represents, right? Think about who the president is, you know, in American political life. We know, research has shown, we know who the president is from the time we're a little kid. The president is an authority figure in our lives from the time we're little kids, right? He is not only the head of government, but the face of America, you know, beyond our shores, internationally. And so for a lot of people, for most of us, especially as we move into adulthood, our identity becomes connected to the presidency, because the presidency represents us all, right? So what happens then if you have someone in that position who no longer looks like you, right? It makes you paranoid. It makes you a little nervous that the commander-in-chief of the military is no longer a white man, right? The chief law enforcement officer is no longer a white man, right? The face of America is no longer a white man, right? That is a powerful symbol to these folks.
But what explains, though, Chris Parker, what explains why conservative America is happy with Condoleezza Rice, with Colin Powell, and they've got this surgeon, I can't remember his name now, this is a new champion of
Ben Carson.
There you go, yeah. So these people, and you got Clarence Thomas, for God's sake, on the Supreme Court. So,
yeah, but I don't think they people really consider him to be black. But anyway, that's a different case.
Right, but if you could give me some insight into why it is that Obama scares the hell out of them and Ben Carson is a hero.
Okay, so let me clarify this. Let's make a distinction between more mainstream moderate conservatives and reactionary conservatives, right? Mm-hmm. So one distinction is that more moderate mainstream conservatives, when you think about these people, if you think about them like back in the 60s when we really started having, when we had this split in conservatives or in the Republican Party, so you had Rockefeller, you had Mitt Romney's daddy, Nixon on one side, right? And then you had Barry Goldwater on the other side. Right. And so you have these more moderate mainstream conservatives. If we think about what conservatives and Republicans did in the 1960s. Right. You had more Republicans vote for civil rights legislation than you did Democrats. So let's get that out there right now. There are different types of conservatives. Right. So more moderate conservative does not necessarily embrace change, does not necessarily want change, but they'd rather have they'd rather have evolutionary organic change versus revolutionary change, right? I mean, Edmund Burke wrote about this, you know, regarding the French Revolution, right? And then you have, and so they understand change is necessary. When you look at these reactionary conservatives, they don't brook any kind of change whatsoever. They actually want to go back in time. Moderate conservatives, they're okay with moving forward incrementally. These folks, these reactionary conservatives, they want to look back in time. They see social change as subversion of their social prestige. And so we have to go backwards in time. So I just want to get that out of the way. So let me answer your question, though, more directly. So why are they okay with, let's say, Condoleezza Rice?
How about Herman Cain? That's a better example.
Okay. They're more comfortable. You know, this is not going to be the most politically correct answer. Just I want you guys to know that I'm black too, so I think I got a little room to run with here. Herman Cain is one of those quote unquote black folks who says and does all the right things and stays in his place. He's a known quantity, right? He's tied to the United States. Same thing with Colin Powell. One of the reasons why, you know, people are upset with Colin Powell now is that he won't stay in his quote-unquote place. Right? Now he says what he thinks. And so he's sort of alienated from the Republican Party. As a matter of fact, he's on record as saying, I didn't leave the Republican Party. The Republican Party left me.
Sure, and he voted for Obama twice. So.
Yes, and he voted for Obama twice. Condoleezza Rice, I mean, she was on, you know, she was on Bush's, she was in Bush's cabinet. And she did everything that Bush asked him to do. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So, in other words, I'm saying that these people, if you think about Colin Powell back in the day, if you think about Condoleezza Rice, if you think about Herman Cain, these are quote unquote exceptional black folk and that they are not recognized as being black because they align their political beliefs with the right. Right. At least Colin Powell, not anymore. Right. But they're quote unquote they're OK as far as black folks go. They're the exceptional black folks who don't act like all the rest of the black folks. Now, for Obama, you know, first of all, he has roots in Kenya, right? His father was a Kenyan national, right? And so they see him as a sort of Manchurian candidate. In other words, the reason why they're so scared of Obama, one of the reasons is because they don't really know much about him, number one, right? Number two, they have to gin up this paranoia in order to make this a battle of, as false as it is, between good and evil. They see him and everything he represents as evil. And what I mean, everything he represents, look at what's happened to same-sex rights since he's been in office. They've gotten better. Right. Look at what's happening to immigration reform. He gets in office. I know that was on the table in 2007. It was gone. He gets in office. He makes that a priority now in his second term, because, quite frankly, Obamacare sucked up all the political oxygen when that went through. But now it's a priority. Right. So you look at these groups who would be considered un-American, you know, gays and lesbians, Latinos, right? And it doesn't make a difference if they're natural born or illegal. They're both looked at in the same light, right? These groups' stature has risen collectively, right? But these are putative un-American or non-Americans as far as the phenotype is concerned.
Well,
so that's why we get these differences.
I see. Well, Chris Parker, again, professor of social justice and political science at the University of Washington, principal investigator of the Multi-State Survey on Race and Politics, and director of the Center for Survey Research at the University of Washington. He's also the author of Fighting for Democracy, Black Veterans and the Struggle Against White Supremacy in the Postwar South. And his latest book, just out, co-written with Matt Barreto, is Change They Can't Believe In, the Tea Party and Reactionary Politics in America. And Chris, we're very grateful to be able to offer you a book up here today in support of Background Briefing and of KPFK. And I wanted to talk to you about it because as we started talking about the breaking news or the continuing news about the IRS scandal, again, a somewhat manufactured scandal along with Benghazi and all these other ones, that the press are now saying that Obama's on the ropes, you know, his presidency is over. I mean, this is not Watergate, this is Whitewater, but nevertheless, what about the book in terms of getting this message out? Because this is, as I've said in this interview, what I take away from your book and why I'm grateful for it, Chris, is that, you know, you've taken the mask off this thing. We've dignified this Tea Party movement, and finally somebody's gotten to paint a real portrait of who they are.
Oh, yeah, thank you. Thank you very much for the opportunity, Ian. Yes, so what we wanted to do, Matt and I, is to take a really precise social scientific measurement of the Tea Party, and that took time. There are several books on the Tea Party that have been published prior to ours, but ours is the first and most meticulous and most social scientific study there is now and that there ever will be. I can guarantee you that. And I say this because we used two surveys, 2010, 2011, that we generated out of the Center for Survey Research at the University of Washington. Moreover, we conducted a content analysis in which we examined the content and compared the content of the National Review Online, which most people would agree that the National Review is the sort of leading light of, you know, conservative intellectual history, at least since Buckley founded in 1955, I believe. And we compared that content to 42 Tea Party websites in 15 states. And the hypothesis is that if the Tea Party is really just conservative, right, and it's really just conservative and nothing else, then that the content between the National Review Online and the Tea Party websites would be, you know, not necessarily identical, but would be very similar. And that couldn't be further from the truth, right? And so we have a pretty good, and then it's a historical narrative that we tell, linking the current Tea Party, the present day Tea Party, with these right wing reactionary groups, you know, across history in the United States. It's the same basic demographic profile, right? This idea that they feel threatened by some change of some kind. When it came to the Know Nothings, it was about you know, Catholic, you know, Irish Catholic immigrants. When we talk about the 1920s and the Klan, it's about the return of the quote unquote new Negro. It's about, you know, the threat from Jews, a perceived threat from Jews, the perceived threat from Italy and the Pope trying to run American politics, right? And then when we skip ahead to the John Birch Society of the 50s and early 1960s, one that I like to mention that Buckley wrote out of the conservative movement because he even thought they were too far out. They felt threatened by, they thought that, you know, these quote-unquote Eastern elites were in league with communist sympathizers, and that the civil rights movement was a Trojan horse for socialism. And so they went on to claim that Dwight D. Eisenhower, you know, the man that oversaw D-Day, was a communist sympathizer, and they tried to get members of the Supreme Court, including Chief Justice Earl Warren, impeached. So we go a long way. We discuss this because we see a lot of threads that link the Tea Party to these other groups. They're not identical, but they're more similar than they are different by a long shot.
So that leads me to ask you, Chris Parker, since we talked earlier about, at least I mentioned how I find it extraordinary how they get away with the most disgraceful language and attitudes and racism and poisonous rhetoric. And maybe this is a continuum as opposed to a high mark in political depravity.
Well, I mean, we certainly think, mean, yeah, the rhetoric has changed consistent with the changing context, right? But I do want to make it clear, though, that these folks are different from the more moderate mainstream conservatives. I mean, if you heard what even George Bush said the other day, you know, that he said, I disagree with Obama's policies, but I want our president to succeed. He said, I want my president to succeed. Right.
Well, that's true. So, but the famous one, of course, was in the campaign in 2008, where this racist woman said he was a Muslim, and McCain said, no, he's not. He's a decent guy. And
right.
and on any number of occasions, Mitt Romney had the same opportunity with racist comments coming from his audiences against Obama, and Mitt Romney did not step up to the plate and act like a decent human being. I just wanted to mention that because that's on the record.
Right, that is definitely on the record. But the point I wanted to make, the salient point I wanted to make is there is some cleavage between the more mainstream moderate conservatives and the ones that are way out there on the far right, indeed the reactionary conservatives that I'm talking about. So that there are some differences, right? I mean, you're going to get George Will and you're going to get David Brooks. You're going to get, I would have said Peggy Noonan, but I can't say her. On one side, and you're going to get the Peggy Noonans, you know, on the other side that are closer to the Tea Party. Sam Tannenhaus would be along with the more moderate conservatives, right? So now you got Ted Cruz, you know, that's in Congress right now. That's a senator, first-term senator from Texas, who's really carrying that Tea Party banner. And I think he and Rand Paul, you know, are going to try to out-Tea Party each other all the way through the 2016 electoral cycle. And let me tell you, my friend, that will be must-see TV.
Well, it will be, and that in itself is a problem. It shouldn't be must-see TV, in as much as I don't think people should be allowed to be rabid without being pulled over. Chris Parker, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Well, thank you, Ian. Thank you for the invitation and the opportunity.
Again, I've been speaking with Chris Parker, who's a professor of social justice and political science at the University of Washington. He is the principal investigator of the Multi-State Survey on Race and Politics, director of the Center for Survey Research at the University of Washington, and author of Fighting for Democracy, Black Veterans and the Struggle Against White Supremacy in the Postwar South. And his latest book, Just Out, co-written with Matt Barreto, is Change They Can't Believe In, the Tea Party and Reactionary Politics in America. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back with a broadcast from October 2nd, 2013, with Norman Ornstein and Thomas Mann.